Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello and welcome back to Indian Religions here on the New Books Network with your host, Dr. Raj Balkaran. Today I have a very special guest. We will get to hear from Dr. Amir Hussain, who is chair at the Theological Studies Department at Loyola Marymount University. He's also vice president of the American Academy of Religion. Amir, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you, Raj. It's a delight and a pleasure to be here with you.
Now, as they say in Calgary, where I did my PhD, this isn't your first rodeo. In that, you have done a podcast for the New Books Network previously to showcase your work on Muslims in America. Let's touch on that. We'll also link that podcast in the notes for this one, so folks can take a deep dive into that work if they're interested. But tell us a little bit about that work.
Sure. So that was a book that came out about 5 years ago called Muslims and the Making of America. So my own backstory in a short version is I grew up in Canada, did a PhD at the University of Toronto looking at Muslim communities in Toronto. You know, how did Muslims get there? How did they establish organizations? All that kind of stuff. And then moved to Los Angeles, got my first teaching job at Cal State Northridge, you know, part of the California state system. And so you move from looking at Muslims in Canada to Muslims in the U.S. And then in 2005, moved to Loyola Marymount University, which is the Jesuit university here in Los Angeles. So all that to say, you know, for the last 25 years, my work has been looking at Muslims in America. As an academic, you know, you're writing to fellow academics about the history of American Muslims, the contributions that American Muslims made to America. And for years, you know, I wanted to write a more sort of, you know, popular book. And in a funny way, the genesis of the book came in 2009 when President Obama had just been elected, had made a speech. He did a lot of traveling in his first few months as president after the January inauguration and had spoke at Cairo University about Islam and Muslims and talked about some of the contributions of American Muslims. I said, hey, most Americans probably don't realize, you know, what President Obama is saying, that American Muslims have fought in our wars, have helped build our tallest buildings, you know, the first country to, one of the first countries to recognize America when it was created was Morocco, a Muslim country, you know, all that kind of history. I thought, oh, most Americans probably don't know this, and wanted to write something about that. But then you get pulled in different directions as an academic. You know, you're doing all sorts of other kinds of things there. And then 2016 happens with the election, with, at that point, you know, candidate Donald Trump saying, I think Islam hates us. And I'm thinking, oh, I have to sort of turn this around a little bit. And my work, so long answer to your point. My work has really been, how is it that American Muslims or North American Muslims have sort of lived out their Islam, you know, in a setting in which they're one, in a minority, you know, Muslims are a small percentage of North Americans, two, incredibly internally diverse, you know, all the kinds of ethnic, linguistic, religious diversity, you know, Sunni, Shia, unaffiliated, whatever. and then having to deal with issues of Western modernity. You know, classical Islamic law doesn't look too kindly on homosexuals. What do you do in California or Toronto where same-sex marriage is a perfectly normal, valid, you know, kind of thing? How do you negotiate those things? So that was my work. The political situation reality sort of made me turn on its head and say, oh, there's a lot of folks who think that American Muslims have contributed nothing to America, who think that American Muslims are at best trying to overthrow America and American values, that American values are distinct from, you know, Islamic culture. And so the book, Muslims, the Making of America, really was an attempt to say, in a very short, not scholarly way, but informed by scholarship, you know, the book is meant for a more general readership to say, you know, here are some of the contributions that American Muslims have made in music, in sports, in culture, in art. Here's some of the way that America has been shaped by its Muslim inhabitants there. So that was really the point of the genesis of the book.
That's fascinating and important work. And we'll point folks to the podcast where they can do a bit of a deeper dive. But I do want to know, even for my own curiosity's sake, is that work that you're continuing in terms of your scholarship currently?
Yeah, absolutely. And so, you know, I'm looking at American Muslims and how American Muslims sort of not just living out their American Islam, but in a funny way, you know, starting to become recognized as key figures for the rest of the Muslim world. So I'll give you two very different kinds of examples. So you look at a person, I'm here in Los Angeles, Sherman Jackson, who teaches at the University of Southern California. Sherman is this phenomenal sort of scholar of Islam in America. He happens to be an African-American Muslim. But he's one of those people that people across the Muslim world are looking to as a Muslim leader. And so this idea, you know, particularly when you come from largely immigrant Muslims in America, have a history that goes back before the slave trade, you know, going back 500 years at least. But the majority of us are immigrants, the children of immigrants, you know, and you always looked, you know, to the country of origin for sort of authenticity and authority. You know, here you've got this American Muslim who, if you look at, you know, the top Muslim thinkers around the world, this American Muslim guy is going to be on that list. So that's one, you know, kind of example here. The other example, again, using local stuff here in Los Angeles, you know, when you had both the beginnings of the Gulf War in Iraq and the sectarian violence that created between Sunnis and Shias, when you had issues in Egypt between Muslims and Copts in Egypt, you had some really powerful moments here of Muslim leaders in Los Angeles, you know, one of the most important Sunni leaders, one of the most important Shia leaders, happens to be from Iraq, doing some really good work around the communities here saying, hey, there's nothing inherent in our Islamic tradition that says Sunnis and Shias should be murdering each other as is happening in Iraq. Or in the case of Egypt, you know, that was when Dr. Hassan and Maher Atoub were the two brothers who really created the Islamic Center of Southern California. And they did this wonderful meeting with Bishop Gerges, who's the Coptic bishop at St. Mark's, you know, the Coptic church here. And so that's another example of, oh, here are Muslims in America who are able to affect what's happening in Egypt, who are able to affect what's happening in Iraq. And so I'm doing that kind of work. But more so, it's become the sort of public understanding of religion and how do you write things that aren't so much scholarly pieces. I mean, you're still involved in that. So my main academic work right now is the Oxford University Press has asked me to be the general editor of their new multi-volume Oxford Encyclopedia of Islam in North America. And so you're collecting together about 125, you know, major length, like 20, 25 page length articles about issues, you know, on Islam in North America. And you're able to do some really great things, including bring in some voices of newer scholars, including bringing in the ideas that are sort of, you know, relevant now. You know, like when I was a graduate student in the 1990s and you're looking at work on Islam, there was nothing about, you know, gender identity in this and Islam or LGBTQ and Islam. You know, that's a really huge issue now. So I'm doing that kind of scholarly work. But so much of it becomes the popular work because, you know, and it's different in Canada because there's a, I think, a larger and a more integrated population. I mean, you mentioned doing your work in Calgary and it's these funny kinds of moments. Like, you know, if you told me in 1990 that, you know, there's a Canadian city who's going to elect a brown Ismaili mayor and one of those choices is Calgary, I would say, no way, there's no way Calgary's going to elect a brown Ismaili guy. And of course, they elect Naeed Nenshi, who's by all accounts a very, very good and very popular mayor there. But, you know, the point there being that for a lot of folks, there's a suspicion, a mistrust, a fear of Islam. And so you almost have to do this kind of work. And in a funny way, you know, we talk with colleagues that, let's say, that do Buddhism, you know, where you almost have to de-exoticize Buddhism, this idea that students come in thinking Buddhism is cool and Buddhism is Zen and Buddhism is, you know, peaceful. And you think of, you know, Michael Jerison, who just passed away earlier this year, you know, with his Buddhist warfare book, with the monk with the gun on the cover, you know, to say, oh, Buddhists have engaged in violence. You know, oh, let's look at Muslims and let's look at the sort of things that Muslims done, some of which is violent, a lot of which is peaceful. But again, that idea of how do you connect, not so much in the academy, you know, but with the larger population.
That intersection is very important. It's actually at the heart of the New Books Network and all of the 100 or so podcasts. The primary and really sole mission of the New Books Network is public education, particularly what is it that academics are working on? What's in these books? Sort of translating them and rendering them accessible. And so your work very much is in alignment with the podcast. And that's why I was very happy that you agreed to come and have a conversation. Because above and beyond being an excellent scholar of a specific niche, you have this very broad view of religion in the public sphere. Publishing in religion, running a theological department. So there's a rich avenue for insight there. Speaking of Calgary, no, please go on.
No.
Speaking of Calgary, I took the scenic route as my podcasts tend to, and I took a year off. I did my master's halftime for 3 years at the University of Toronto. I've heard of this, the holy city of Toronto. I did my BA and master's there. I took a year off and then I found this excellent fit in advisor and program in terms of a fantastic scholar of the Puranas who happened to be at the University of Calgary. She was a student of Anne Monius, Beth Rollman. And so I approached one R.T. Dond, who was my undergrad prof at what point, and I said, you know what, you did some of your training at Calgary. I really want to go apply to the University of Calgary for this program. Will you write a letter for me? And probably very sort of protectively, she pushed back a bit. She goes, are you sure you want to go to Calgary? you really want to leave Toronto where you've been your whole life and go to Calgary? You know, she was intimating sort of some different culture clash sort of there. And I said, well, actually, I want to go to this program. And that's at the University of Calgary, because I know I have my spidey sense says that's the advisor for me. And so I get off a plane. They graciously decided to fly me out to see if I'd like to come to the program. Get off the plane and I'm speaking with one of the cab drivers, you know, much like the Bhagavad Gita, you know, Uber drivers and cab drivers are sagacious. They're just so full of wisdom. And so I said, look, he was an African Canadian gentleman. I said, look, level with me. What's it like out here? You know, this is one of the concerns of one of my advisors. And he laughed at me. He goes, you do realize that our mayor is a brown man. I didn't even know. It's hilarious. Anyhow, shortly after entering that program, I got to interact with you in that I submitted my master's thesis for publication at the Journal of the American Academy of Religion. We'll talk about the American Academy of Religion momentarily, but can you tell us about your role there? You were then the editor of that journal. What was that like?
Yeah, and so that was a really lovely experience. And again, we'll say more about the AAR. You know, it's the largest academic group really for the study of religion. And I joined, you know, when I was a graduate student, like a lot of us do, and worked in a couple of different groups. But then for a 5-year term from 2011 to 2015, I was editor of their journal. So the Journal of the American Academy of Religion is, you know, the flagship journal for the AAR. It's published by Oxford University Press. It goes out, you know, 4 times a year to the sort of 8,000 members of the AAR and the 4,000 libraries, institutions that, you know, get that journal. And for me, it was a really lovely opportunity in a couple of different ways. One was just to be able to increase my learning curve. You know, I'm a scholar of Islam, more specifically Islam in North America, but the JAR, the Journal of the American Academy of Religion, is the Journal of the American Academy of Religion. So there's articles on Hinduism, on Buddhism, on method and theory here, on feminist issues in disability studies with Judaism, you know, all those kinds of things. And so my learning curve went through the roof because you're learning about all these different kinds of things there. So that's one thing. Now, the other thing, we were able to do it here at Loyola Marymount University, which is a you know, really liberal arts undergraduate teaching focus. We have a master's program. We don't have a PhD program, but it was an amazing opportunity for our students to be able to help with the work of the journal. So, for example, like the viewing, of course, had to be done by established scholars. That's the nature of a scholarly journal. But to be able to find those pieces. So, I mean, thinking about your piece, you know, about the Ramayana, you know, we get this in, we do sort of a first read to say, you know, is this sort of acceptable? And, you know, most things are, a few things are, yeah, this is really not for us. And that could be, let me just say one thing about that. That could be for different reasons. It could be that this is a real technical article. Like if you'd submitted a piece that really required a third year Sanskrit to be able to understand the sort of philological arguments, we'd say, oh, this is a marvelous paper. It's just not right for us. This really belongs in a, you know, maybe even a Sanskrit studies journal or certainly a Hindu studies journal where people need to know the language to be able to appreciate the argument. Or it could be that, you know, yeah, this is much more a theological kind of argument of, you know, this is a normative prescriptive, here's how we should act in the world. You know, yeah, that's not what we do here, you know, there. But anyway, as long as it passes that first test, then we have to look for the experts, the reviewers who can look at this. And so that's where our students are great, because you're able to say to them, okay, here's this piece that looks at, using yours as an example, at the Ramayana. Who are the people that work in this? It's also a piece that looks at war and warfare. So who are the people that are writing about, you know, war and religion? You're smart students. You come back to me with a list of, you know, 5 people who are writing about the Ramayana and 5 people who are writing about, and then we contact them and ask them to do that kind of work. And then, you know, it goes out there for review. The reviewers look at it. It comes back to us. We get the reviews. And then we needed to have, you know, 2 positive reviews for something to move forward. And then they're blind reviews. And so using your paper as an example, you have no idea if this is coming. I mean, I do, because I'm the one that sort of receives them electronically. But no one else has any idea if you're a master's student, a PhD student, or you're the top scholar in the field who's published 5 books in this area. It's really what's the piece, you know, there. And that blind view, I think, is so important. And then just finishing up with our students, you know, one of the really nice things is when all is said and done, being able to lay this out for them, because it's so hard to teach people about writing without sort of examples, and to say, okay, here's the piece that came in, you know, here's the 2 reviewer suggestions, you know, here's me as the editor incorporating those reviewer suggestions into a letter saying, yeah, we're going to accept this article, but reviewers want you to make these changes. I'd like you to make these changes, you know, then you get that, you submit that revised version. That then goes for copy editing, then it goes for a final edit, and then it gets published. And so if you look at the thing that you submitted first and the thing that, you know, was actually published in the journal, 90% of it is probably exactly the same. But that 10% that changed because the reviewers, you know, that kind of thing. But being able to show the students, you know, this is the kind of work that needs to be done. This is the sort of thing that, you know, when you're done your first draft, you're just that, done your first draft. This is not the final version. So, you know, the piece that you submitted to us, as good as it was, hopefully became better in the editing process so that when it was published, it really was a much better sort of piece. And so that was a real joy to be able to do that. But it's a ton of work. I mean, you're basically publishing a 300-page book, you know, every 3 months. And, you know, there's nothing like, you know, getting the issue of, let's say, the March issue that came out in the mail. You've already had the September issue, you know, there in press, and you're already working on the December issue. You know, like when you write a book, you get to sit back, you get to relax, you get to put your feet up. With this, it was like just all the time, and there was always stuff to do, precisely because it's the journal of the AAR going out to 8,000 members and 4,000 libraries. So we never had to, you know, with some small journals, you have to worry about your circulation. You know, how are we going to get this out there? Who's going to buy this? Well, every single member of the AAR gets this as part of their membership. So in my case, it wasn't about, you know, trying to increase the circulation. It was really trying to increase the readership and the quality. This goes back to our first conversation about, you know, public orientation and scholarship that's really more read. You know, I've been in people's offices where they had the jar and it was still wrapped in plastic. Like they hadn't even taken the plastic off for a year and looked at it. You know, they just gotten it in the mail, put it on their desk or put it in the bookshelf. You know, for me, it was like, I want you to open the plastic. I want you to look at it. Let's add some pictures. Let's add some art. You know, online, we can do color things. One of the things I was really proud of, and I'll say one thing here and I'll stop. You know, when I interviewed for the position, I brought in a copy of the journal. And on the back, it said, you know, please submit this. So this would have been 2009, 2010 that I'm doing this interview, which is important for what I'm going to say next. The back of the journal said, please submit 3 paper copies and a disc of your article. I'm like, a disc? I haven't used a disc since like 2002. Like, I don't even know if they make them anymore. Like, we're still submitting like paper copies that then get mailed out to reviewers. Like, how much time and money is that? You know, and at that point, you know, a lot of the online journal platforms were ramping up and being in use. So we use Oxford University Press, use Scholar One, which is Thomson Reuters sort of software. But that was great to be able to do these kinds of things. And so, but just that sense of, you know, how do you bring this into the modern world? And we publish in black and white because it's cheaper, but online we could be in color. And so I remember the first thing that we did, which had to do with some things around Korean Buddhist figures. It's like, oh, let's put a dozen of them on the website in full color, where you can look at them, you know, so you don't have to spend 2 pages describing this thing, or for that matter, with a video, you know, here's this article that looks at this, you know, temple. Well, you don't have to spend 3 pages describing the temple. You can just, you know, with your cell phone, record a really nice HD quality video that we could then link onto the webpage. So people can go to the webpage, click on the link and sort of see the temple and then read your analysis of it. So that part, I think, for me was really great. And you know, you tried to bring in some artwork, you tried to bring in some poetry, you know, not to turn into a poetry journal, but what has the pandemic taught us? I mean, the pandemic has taught us lots of things, obviously, but you know, who do we turn to make sense of this? We turn to artists, we turn to poets, we turn to painters. No one looks at, let me read a deep scholarly article to help make sense of this. I say that as someone who's a scholar. You know, we turn to the essayists, we turn to the poets, we turn to the writers, we turn to the artists, you know. And so how do you have some of that in there?
There's so many fascinating threads there. I'll start in no particular order. I mean, as you probably have surmised by now, my conversations aren't scripted. They're organic. You know, when I finished the PhD, I defended in 2015, and the job market was just atrocious. And then there were certain shifts in the landscape in America, shall we say, where the vast majority of the jobs are. And I decided to stay in Toronto and find a way to support myself and produce scholarship. Through that process, I went from deeply never having taken an entrepreneurship or business course or marketing course in my life, barely knowing what those words meant, frankly, I had this sort of transformation of deeply resenting and being at odds with having to worry about, you know, packaging and presentation. And then realizing that, oh my God, it's the difference between whether 10 or 10,000 people can access the actual content, because we're human beings. We taste with our eyes first, right? The name of a course that I pitch, just the name can make a difference of a factor of 10, exactly the same content in terms of who will be interested or register. So, I had no idea that you were so instrumental in that shift with the jar, but it must be deeply rewarding that you were able to bring it into the 21st century and also make it more inviting and more engaging for folks. So fantastic. I just want to say a quick note. It was a deeply formative and fulfilling experience for me, actually. I through some fascinating synchronicity, I ended up crossing paths with a professor of defense studies at the College for the Canadian Armed Forces. And his job was to literally teach justified force, justified violence. Like, he was teaching people when it was okay to pull the trigger or make the call. And I was a hopeless pacifist at the time. You know, Gandhi was my hero. But through the course of our cross-pollination, I really came to understand that we do want our police officers to carry weapons for the most part. We do want PIN numbers on our accounts. We do want locks on our doors. We do want recourses for people who transgress. I ended up, I was doing a master's on the Valmiki Ramayana, fascinated with what I now think of as a dharmic double helix, as kind of justified force versus utter ahimsa. And I didn't have a word for it then, but Dr. Walter Dorn, he was an expert in just war theory. And so he provided this lens, this theoretical model with which I could look at the Valmiki Ramayana and where I live as primary text. So it was clear to me to see where these criteria exist, but they're encoded in conversation, in the plot, in the characterization. It's all there. And so after the master's was finished, he wanted to publish this. I never published anything in my life, and I just finished a master's. And so we submitted it to a journal that on paper might have been an even closer fit for the niche of religious ethics. And it was rejected. And I thought, okay, well, let's move on. And he's like, nope, let's find another journal. And he's like, let's submit it to the jar. I'm like, are you out of your mind? You're going to submit this to the jar? So this double blind peer review probably worked in my favor, because it sort of saves you from the potential prejudice of, well, this guy is a master's student doing a PhD at the University of Calgary. Like, who the heck is he? Let's move on, shall we? We've got serious scholars whose work we should look at. So it was a really rewarding experience, because, of course, the feedback is always useful. Of course, you end up with a paper that you're more proud of at the end of that process. And it really taught me something that has stayed with me for the last, I don't know, 10, 12 or so articles, chapters. My goal is to aim for the B plus when I'm submitting, because they're going to have ways in which to make it an A or an A plus. They're going to have their expertise and their bent. And it may be an A plus for you, but they're always going to have a different level. So I'm like, I'm going to aim for that B plus, because I know they're going to have specific advice on how to fully bake this thing. So it was a really enriching and formative experience for me. Little did I know I'd have you on a podcast some years later, but here we are.
No, I'm delighted at that. And the other thing I would say too, and I would say this all the time to people who are writing articles, is show it to other people first. You know, ideally be able to present it, get some feedback first, because the last thing you want is to be working in complete isolation, send this off to an editor who sends this out to reviewers who say, like, have you been working in complete isolation? Do you not know about this person or this person or this idea or that idea? And so, you know, at some level, are you able to sort of, you know, share this with folks? So for me, the ideal has always been, okay, you know, you work in your office, you work where you can to do the kind of stuff, but then you share it with a couple of folks, you get some feedback, you ideally may be able to present it at a conference or something. That's where you get sort of almost like the first level of peer review. And that's when you then rework it and then you submit it in. And then that's where it goes out and gets the more specific kinds of things. So absolutely, you know, don't send it. And I love that analogy that you used of, you know, B+, don't send something in that's F word, because we got things that were like, you know, fill in footnote 6 here or, you know, add this thing. And I'm like, come on, you've submitted something to us that isn't even complete or, you know, that kind of thing. Like that's a little bit disrespectful. But, you know, you put what you think is the best work, knowing that, as you said, you'll have, you know, expert reviewers look at it, you'll have good people looking at it. And so, like, my editing skills, you know, improved tremendously. And I just want to say one thing there, and that was that distinction of, you know, editing people for clarity and accuracy is a very different thing than editing for voice. And I'm thinking now, because I was doing this work, you know, 6 years ago, like I stopped editing the journal in 2015. So I haven't done it for, you know, 6 years. But you think now about all the conversations on voice and authority and who speaks for whom and, you know, all that kind of work. And I was really proud of the fact that as much as possible, you know, we tried to make that distinction. Okay, here's clarity, here's accuracy, here's grammatically correct. I mean, I remember getting something that, you know, was the first sentence literally was a paragraph. It was, I think, 12 lines. I'm like, yeah, that's a really good German sentence. It's 5 English sentences. You know, let's break this up into 5 much shorter sentences, because in English, it makes much more sense here. But you try as much as possible never to affect the author's voice, to say, it's still you writing this in the way that you write and by analogies speak, you know, there. And I think that becomes really interesting, of how many editors are more on the voice side rather than the, oh, here's, you know, accuracy, clarity, grammatical correctness, you know, that kind of thing.
Yeah, it's fascinating. It really is. So this journal, this premier journal in the study of religion, whatever that is, this American Academy of Religion, what is the AAR? What's it all about? And what do you do as the VP of it?
Sure. So let me start with the AAR first, then work back to the governance structure there. But the American Academy of Religion is literally, you know, the largest scholarly group for the academic study of religion. It's an international, it has American in the title, I'll get back to that in a second, but it's an international group. I don't have the exact numbers in front of me, but I would suspect about 70% of the scholars in it are from the United States. I think about 10% are from Canada, about 20% are from the rest of the world. But the mission statement, it's funny, you could sort of almost recite this from memory, that the mission is to foster excellence in the academic study of religion and enhance the public understanding of religion. You know, that had to do with one of the things we were talking about, you know, the public understanding as opposed to the scholarly kinds of things there. So it's a scholarly organization started 100 years ago as the National Association of Bible Instructors. In the 1960s, when you had changes to the teaching of religion in American universities and the growth of religious studies departments, same thing, you know, in across North America, where, you know, many things may have started. Like the University of Toronto started as King's College, an Anglican college to train men and exclusively men, you know, for the Anglican priesthood, you know. 150 years later, it's the biggest research university in Canada. Completely different kind of thing. But in its origins, it was like this divinity school, you know. How do you then shift to the 1960s and 70s to the academic study of religion as distinct from preparing men or even at that point, you know, women for ordination, you know, that kind of thing there. So what started as a more narrow organization, the National Association of Bible Instructors, became the American Academy of Religion. It's sort of famous for a couple of things. You know, one is the annual meeting that happens in November, the sort of largest gathering of scholars this year. We're hoping to have it in person in San Antonio, Texas. The journal of the AAR that goes out 4 times a year. There are regions, and so many people, myself included, started not going to the national meeting, but to the regional. You know, growing up in Toronto was the Eastern International region. And so I think my very first AR meeting was in upstate New York, like Alfred, New York. And then it was years later that you went to my first annual meeting was in San Francisco in 1992. And so it's this great opportunity for scholars of religion to connect with each other. You know, I do the study of Islam, and unless you're at a major research university, if you're hired in a position to teach about Islam, you're typically the only person there, you know. So I teach in a theology department that has, you know, 19 full-time faculty members. I'm the only one that works on Islam, you know. And so if I want to have a conversation about Islam, I have to go talk to, you know, Sherman Jackson at USC or Zane Kassem, you know, at Pomona College, you know. You have to go somewhere else. And so the AAR can be really valuable because many of us are connected through our different academic interests. So you're involved in the study of Islam, or you're involved in religions in South Asia, or in Hinduism, or in, you know, gay men's issues, and really whatever. And so it's a great opportunity to connect with those folks, to have those kinds of conversations. So that's more about the AAR sort of broadly. I got to be a member of it, you know, as a graduate student, and then you get involved in the various groups. So, you know, there's different groups and sections, like the study of Islam section, the religion, film, visual culture, you know, those kinds of things. You get involved in the leadership of those groups, get on a steering committee, become elected as the chair, for example, because it's like anything else in academia. It's a volunteer driven organization. You're not paid to do any of this. You know, it's the service to the profession that we do there. And then a couple of years ago, I ran for a spot on the AAR board of directors. So you've got an executive director, and then you've got a board of directors there who run the organization. And then last year got elected to the vice presidency. So that's a 1 year sort of slot as vice president, but it's really moving through the presidential line. So this year I'm vice president, which means I'm part of the board of directors, which I was already as an at-large member. You're involved in the program committee, which sort of oversees the large annual meeting. You're part of the executive committee. You're part of the audit committee that has to do with, you know, the finances of the organization. But then next year, I'll become, well, technically this November, I'll become the president-elect, and then next year I'll become the president. So a lot of organizations do that rather than sort of bring someone in as a president cold. It's like, okay, let's come in through a presidential line. So for first year, you're vice president. Next year, you're president-elect. Third year, you're president. When you're president, you the sort of perk that you have is at the annual meeting, you set the plenary sessions. You're able to invite the plenary speakers that you want to have, which is not a huge number. It's, you know, four sessions out of, you know, the hundreds of sessions that are there.
There's so much there. Clearly, you also got the administration gene. the AAR I found to be like all conferences, there's all kinds of stimulation that comes with having an immersive environment with folks engaged in certain questions or certain methods. But in my case in particular, I found it to be an extremely useful networking tool. Being in the right place at the right time, all of a sudden you're part of this Navaratri research group out of Oslo, or you're having lunch with C. Mackenzie Brown, pinching yourself because, you know, he was writing before, you know, you were born or whatever. And also, it's really afforded opportunities for anybody, you know, with the admin gene to, you know, to help organize, to help. I think for a while I was the student director for the Pacific Northwest, ambassador positions. There are all kinds of opportunities for whereby you can help bring people together and raise awareness about the study of religion. Which brings me to something I wanted to ask you about in terms of the core mission of the American Academy of Religion. In your view, what is being done in terms of raising awareness about the study of religion for the public? Or what does that look like? Or what could that look like?
Yeah, no, that's a great question. So we've done a number of different things, you know, because for the longest time, you know, we were this scholarly organization that consisted of, you know, tenure track professors who did, you know, very great, and I'm not knocking away this sort of scholarly kind of work. But then the economic and other realities sit in. And so, you know, 30% of our members are graduate students. You know, you've had exactly that life experience where that old world, and I'm saying in 1997 that I had, where, you know, I graduated with a PhD, I was able to get a tenure line job, I was then able to move into a second, you know, tenure line job. Those days are very, very different now. Like, you know, we're fortunate if we get a full-time visiting position, you know, or a one-year position at a graduate school, forget about a tenure line, you know, kind of thing. And so the rise in contingent faculty, universities figuring out decades ago that, oh, you can pay a lot of people a very little amount of money to teach courses rather than pay, you know, two or three people, you know, decent living wage salaries and only have them teach three or four courses there. And so exactly that with the AAR, that, you know, how do you deal with the new reality of things where folks aren't in that kind of position? So that's one side of things, you're just from within the profession. From the outside is all the kinds of things around religion, the sort of growth in, when I say different religion, I have to be very, very careful here. What I mean by that is, you know, in a North American context in which, you know, people knew something about Christianity and Judaism, everything else is kind of exotic, you know, Hindus, Buddhists, Muslims, you know, whatever. And that's a real difference that, you know, when my family moved to Toronto in 1970, Toronto was like 85% British, like not 85% white, 85% British. Like the Italian was the exotic other, you know. Now Toronto is the most multicultural city in the world, you know, and you see those kinds of differences. And so, you know, I think now of my mentor, and I was so privileged to have, you know, Wilfred Cantwell Smith, a great Canadian scholar of religion, who had taught it at McGill and then Harvard and then retired back to Toronto. And I connected with him as a grad student there. You know, one of his last books, the original title was The Faith of Other Men. You know, and when he revised it in 1999, he said, look, I have to change the title. You know, first of all, the obvious men, like we're not talking about men, we're talking about women, you know, there. But other, like in 1960 in Canada, Hindus were other. In 1999, Hindus are not the other in Canada anymore. You know, you have Hindus in Parliament, you have Hindu temples, that, you know, it's that sort of idea. So anyway, where I'm going with this is that how do you deal with that changing reality? And that's where I think the AAR, to get to your question, has been really good. So one of the things that they did a few years ago was just, you know, how do we help with educators K through 12? You know, in a lot of places, I live in the U.S., I live in Los Angeles, fourth grade in Los Angeles, California is California history, which includes the California missions. 11th grade, you do world religion. So as part of the California curriculum, in grade 4 and in grade 11, you have to deal with religion. You know, that's part of like, how do you understand the world without understanding religion, politics, culture, you know, that kind of thing. So how do we help K through 12 teachers with that? You know, the second thing that we did, which we just finished, was what are the sort of general guidelines that any university graduate should know about religion? Understanding, that only about 20% of universities have a religion department. You know, most universities don't even have a religion department. What do you do with someone who's doing an associate's degree here and going on to become a nurse? You know, we all know that, you know, a nurse working in a hospital is going to encounter people of different religions, you know. So how do we get nurses, you know, trained something about religion? What do we do? So that kind of work, I think, becomes really important. Working with different news organizations provide a scholarly base so that when an organization says, hey, we're interested in something here about Hinduism or something about Buddhism, or, you know, what's going on in Burma and why are these Buddhists fighting other Buddhists? You know, can you give us someone who can talk about that? And I think that goes to the heart of what you do here with this podcast, that, you know, I may write a scholarly article and I may get, you know, two or three people emailing me about it. You know, it may be downloaded like, you know, 30 times in a month. And that's like a runaway bestseller in the scholarly article world. You know, if I've done something that, you know, was on a History Channel show or something else, I know that that's been rebroadcast because I'll get 10 emails, you know, about that. You know, no one emails me 3 years later about an article. Someone who's seen me on a rerun of a television show is going to send me an email there. And so I think exactly that, you know, how do we connect? Because there's this huge hunger, I think, with the public to sort of understand religion. You know, I'll say one more thing here and I'll stop. Like years ago, I created a death and dying class, you know, basically, you know, world religions and it's called Death and Dying in the World's Religions. And what I sort of naively assumed, this is, you know, having taught for 10 years, was that, well, students would sort of think, okay, well, you know, I'm a Christian, I kind of know something about Christianity, but how do Hindus deal with death? How do Buddhists deal with death? How do Muslims deal with death? And what you realize was, oh, Christians don't know how to deal with death. Like, no one's given the Christian students a sense of, here's the Christian theological tradition's take on what it means to live and die and what the proper burial rituals are and all that kind of stuff. And so it's like, oh, we have to help people understand their own traditions if they have to come from one, as much as, you know, the traditions of other religious folks. But anyway, all that to say that I think that that's where the AAR has been doing a much better job of branching out from that very narrow, which, and I don't mean in a negative way, because when it was created, it really was, here's this scholarly organization of scholars, and scholars meant, you know, tenured, mostly men, mostly white folks who studied mostly Judaism and Christianity, you know, who were writing scholarly articles basically for each other, to how do we speak to the large society about this?
Yeah, there's a real transformation afoot, or maybe I'm just sort of in it. Maybe just occurring in the circles that I connect with. But, you know, upon defending the as I mentioned, the job market was tricky, and I just had this inclination that, you know what, I'm going to produce scholarship one way or another. If I can, I will. If I went to the AAR and someone asked, where are you at? I may sheepishly mention that I was teaching online, you know, privately or coaching. Real mark of shame in my mindset then. In my mindset born of an internalized value system, an internalized ideal of what a proper scholar is versus a failed academic or versus a ex, whatever. I mean, these are myths in the pejorative sense that we internalize and we take as reality. And it took a couple of years to really shake that and realize, you know, when the first book came out about the Rutledge, I thought, I just published a book with Rutledge. This isn't holding me back. You know, what's my issue? What's my issue? I am a scholar. I'm producing scholarship. What if a professorship ripens and it's a great fit? Fantastic. I would love to have a hand in corrupting the youth, among other things. And if not, I'll continue producing scholarship. And then when COVID hit, all of a sudden, hey, Raj, you know those online courses you were talking about? And so I sort of come full circle with that. I wonder, from your perspective of being a very seasoned, established scholar with this wide range of administrative research experience, is this Pathamon atypical? Like, what do you see for young folks coming out?
No, I think absolutely. I think your path becomes really the more typical path. And my path, you know, the PhD straight into a tenure line position is the atypical one now. And the online world, I think, you know, before COVID hit, you know, my university used Brightspace as its sort of, you know, platform for online learning. Up until 2019, my Brightspace page literally was my syllabus. Like all that I did everything literally paper. Like I gave my students like paper handouts. I used all sorts of video and stuff in class, but I didn't do anything online. Then COVID hits. Last 6 weeks, we have to be online. All of a sudden, I have to learn about it. I've never taught an online course in my life. And so it's people like you who now become the experts. Like, oh, you want to learn about online teaching? I've been doing this for a while. Here's what you need to do. Here's this. And, you know, and I can tell you horror stories of colleagues who did like 3 hour Zoom lectures. And I'm like, wait, you can't, like, after an hour on Zoom, you get tired. You shouldn't be lecturing for 3 hours in person. Why do you think lecturing for 3 hours? Do you think anyone's actually going to pay attention to this? Like, you know, and how do you rethink the courses and what do? You know, all that kind of stuff. Which is a very different way, which can create all sorts of really lovely opportunities. So, for example, like with my Islam in America class, to be able to say to the students, okay, on the Brightspace page, here's a link to the Library of Congress that has this Omar ibn Said collection of 40 pieces, including the autobiography of Omar ibn Said, the first, you know, African Muslim slave to write an autobiography in Arabic, translating it. Here's the National Museum of African American History and Culture. Here's their exhibit on Muslim slaves. Go take a look at this, you know, and write me something about what you found there. You know, that kind of stuff, I think, becomes so powerful because online, I can't send my students to the Library of Congress because that's a 2,500-mile plane ride away. But we can go onto the website and look at the materials, do that kind of stuff. So anyway, back to your question, I think you represent, I think, what is going to be happening here, you know, how do you make a living for yourself? How do you have a scholarly reputation that doesn't require a tenure track position? Because that's in the minority now. And the fact that you're able to publish Rutledge is a very respected academic press, you know, and the idea that, yeah, it really should be about the work, not about this is a person who's got a tenured position at X university. It's no, this is a good work in this area, you know, and the person has the qualifications, you have the ability there, you know, to do that. But then, you know, sort of scrambling to make a living, you teach these courses here, you teach those courses here. Can you create your own kinds of courses? Can you reach a much larger audience? And that was apparent to me with the kinds of stuff that you do with the podcasts here. Because like I said, you know, if I get 30 downloads in a month, you know, of a scholarly article, that's a runaway success. You know, how many thousands of downloads do you get?
We get tens of thousands a month for this channel currently.
For that channel. And so and that's the thing, that you're literally having, you know, tens of thousands of people who are paying attention, who are listening, you know, to what you and the people you're working with, you know, have to say. And so I think that's a huge kind of thing, you know, and in the same way, it's different, but I see an analogy. It's like writing a textbook. You know, you teach a class of 30 students or 100 students or 200 students, you know, whatever your class size is. You write a textbook that's used by 1,000 students. You do a podcast that's listened to by 10,000, you know, students there. And so I think that becomes really important. And in many ways, the nice thing about this is that it removes some of the artificial gatekeepers. You know, the downside of this is that, you know, some of those gatekeepers are important because, you know, just because you have 1 million Twitter followers doesn't mean you have anything interesting to say. You know, you might well have 1 million Twitter followers precisely because you're, I'm not saying this about you, but, you know, because of course you say things that are outrageous and obnoxious and whatever, and people, you know, have a desire for that. But I think precisely that this idea that, oh, you can by yourself with the technology that you have that doesn't require the CBC recording studio of $100,000 of equipment or that kind of thing, and the ability now. And I think in a funny way, we couldn't have done the pivot to online teaching that we did in 2020 in 2017, because we just didn't have that technology to be able to do that. You know, the fact that I'm sitting here in my office in Los Angeles, you're sitting there in Toronto, you've got, you know, some really nice equipment. I've got like a, you know, $50 headset with a microphone, but that still works pretty well in terms of the sound and what we're able to do and the editing software, all that kind of stuff, that you can do this. And so I think going back to your question, it's really what you're doing that is going to be more and more what, not even going to be, it is what the majority of folks are doing. You know, the majority of us teaching in the study of religion are not people like me, you know, with a tenured position. You know, they're people like you who don't have a tenured position, who may be adjuncting here or a contingent person here or a visitor there, or who may not even have, you know, an affiliation with a university, but are still able to do the kinds of work that needs to get done.
Fascinating. I want to be mindful of your time today, but maybe one final, fairly open-ended question. You could take it in a number of directions. And given your particular vantage point, in terms of academic publishing and teaching, and obviously having come through the pandemic, and we're getting there anyways, you know, what trends are you noticing? Like, what's really standing out to you in terms of the shifting landscape of academic research, teaching, publishing? Like, what, you know, what's emerging in your brain of making sense of the shifts?
So much of it. I mean, we've talked about interdisciplinary things and collaborative things, and I think, you know, again, your point that we came to earlier, you know, you doing the thing with Walter Dorn, you know, here's the scholar of the Ramayana with the scholar of just war theory, you know, having those kinds of things, I think, is so important, you know, so that kind of work, the shift. And this has happened for the last couple of decades, so it's not anything new. The shift away from texts, sort of as philological sort of things, to how those texts are lived, how those texts are interpreted, how those texts are read, and you know, and you know this much better than I do because of your work. But you look at the Ramayana, and you know, have most people in India sat down and read the Valmiki Ramayana? No, they have not. They've seen it on TV. They've seen it on their computer. They've read it in a comic. Like, you know, so how is it being understood and appreciated? You know, in that kind of way, that goes to the whole visual culture. So, you know, 25 years ago, this religion film was a brand new kind of thing, and now, I don't think you can go to an AAR annual meeting without, you know, having visual components to things. My own sense now is music, you know, that's going to be the next kind of a thing there. And by that, I don't mean like religious music in the sense of like a Bach Passion, no knock against that. But, you know, I was just talking with a friend about, you have to bring up another Canadian, Bruce Coburn, you know, as a singer-songwriter, you know, who's deeply informed by his own sort of Christianity, and yet his songs are not, you know, Christian songs. They're not hymns. I mean, One Day I Walk, you might sort of sing in a church, but, you know, that sense of religious music, not just being the songs you sing in church for an hour a week, but what are the songs you sing for the other, what, 167 hours? So the music, you know, there, the popular culture, you know, one of the things in the AAR that's really taken off in the last couple of years out of religion, film, visual culture has been the religion video games, the gaming, you know, kind of thing. And that world, like I'm not in that world, but my university, literally, I can look down from the bluff where the university is down the hill to like EA Sports and Google and Facebook and some of those companies. And I remember talking with one of our students about working for a video game company. He says, well, you have to understand, there's more writers than there are engineers. Like, there's only a couple of guys that do the coding. They have a team of writers to write the story. And you look at how religion, you know, is brought into those kinds of things. The popular culture, the film stuff, you know, the fact that 10 years ago now, living in Los Angeles, you know, I got called by a television show who said, oh, we're doing, you know, that this show that's about a police officer, but there's a religious component to it. Would you be willing to be an advisor for us about religion? Sure. You know, that show was Saving Grace with Holly Hunter, you know, and I never would have thought I would have worked on a television show with Holly Hunter. You know, what's this, a person who works on Islam going to be doing, you know, on a television show? But, you know, the fact that this show had religion sort of as a subtext, you know, became really interesting. So that kind of thing, I think, becomes really important, that the popular culture elements of things, that religion, and maybe let me say this and I'll stop, that religion isn't just, you know, the 1 hour that you're in church or mosque or synagogue or the temple a week. It's what happens the rest of your time, you know, and how do we account for those sorts of things?
Fantastic. I want to thank you very much for making the time to appear on the podcast today. That was fun.
No, thanks, Roger. It's been a great, real privilege. And thank you for what you do here. I think this is really, really important.
Thank you very much. For those of you listening, we have been speaking with Dr. Amir Hussain, who is the chair of theological studies at Loyola Marymount University and also the vice president of the American Academy of Religion. Until next time, stay safe, stay sane, and keep contemplating the role of religion. Take care.